books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, a long chat with author Nydia Hetherington on living with a chronic condition, on medical misogyny, and about her books, A Girl Made of Air and Sycorax. Sycorax by Nydia Hetherington is a beautifully imagined tale of the life lived before the tempest by the great witch Sycorax, blending myth, feminism and illness. And we'll hear from Nydia about how living with a chronic condition and working in theatre inspired her own writing. The book is both written and read by Nydia Hetherington.
It is cold. The island hums. It knows I cannot sleep and tries only to soothe me. Moonlight touches my face. I lift my chin a little, bathe in the brightness, and blink. White beams reach like arms into my cave as I crouch on the smooth rock at its mouth. As always, the moon's beauty makes me gasp. Hairs rise on the back of my neck. I like the sensation. Resting heavily upon my staff, my trusty aid, still fragrant with the sap of the tree it came from, I enjoy the fresh bite of the cool night air. It will be hot when daytime comes, sweat will cling to us. As I shiver, the song of the waking island risks lulling me back into slumber, even as its scents of hibiscus, mushroom and mint make me thirst for the day and its heat. How I love the contradiction. I try to stretch, but my limbs are too stiff and ache. In truth, I am racked with pain, but no more nor less than usual. I shrug, and turning towards a snuffling, snoring mound behind me, cannot help but smile. There's no sadness here.
Sycorax is the story of the witch in William Shakespeare's The Tempest. Now you might think, well, there is no witch in William Shakespeare's The Tempest, and you would be right, because she is not seen on stage. She is only spoken about. She's actually the mother of Caliban, who is referred to as a monster by Prospero and is Prospero's slave in The Tempest. We know very little from The Tempest about her, other than that Prospero calls her a foul witch and that she is bent almost into a hoop and that she is a blue-eyed hag from Algiers. That's all we know about her. That's all the information we have. So I have given her back her voice, and I have written her story literally from the moment of her birth to the moment she arrives on that island where the tempest is set. So if you like, it is a prequel to the tempest, although that sounds extremely ambitious. So that's basically what Sycorax is, and that's what she's about.
My son sleeps, spindle-limbed and chubby-faced, tucked into his bed of leaves and moss, of spider silk and crow feathers. He is safe. The moon's light pools about him, while the steady flicker of my everlasting candle, the eternal flame I brought to this place when he was but a fish in my belly, dances beside him.
And why was it important to you that Sycorax was living with a chronic illness?
So I have rheumatoid arthritis, which is, and when people hear the word rheumatoid arthritis, they think of osteoarthritis. They think, oh yeah, you've got sore joints, you're a bit worn out. But that's not what rheumatoid arthritis is. It's an autoimmune disease, very like lupus or MS. In fact, I've got a friend who has lupus who's on exactly the same medication that I'm on. And it is an illness that causes a great deal of pain, a great deal of fatigue, and it affects every part of your life. So obviously, as a writer, it's part of who I am. It's part of how I see the world. I see the world through my illness, and I'm not going to shy away from it. And I'm not going to say I'm not going to be, a lot of people say I'm not going to be defined by my illness, but I feel like I am defined by my illness just by the fact that I live with it every day. And it's noticeable to me that women throughout history, and certainly in literature and through art, women are often depicted, certainly as witches, as old hags. They're often bent, they've got gnarled hands. And to me, gnarled hands and bent backs suggest pain. I wanted to kind of look at this idea that history treats unwell women extremely unkindly. If women don't fit a certain mold, if they're not young for a start, if they're not healthy, then they have to be monstrous. And I kind of wanted to examine that through this book and through the character of Sycorax, because it's very important in The Tempest that Prospero makes sure we know how monstrous she truly is. And so that's where that springs from.
Yeah, I was in education with someone who had rheumatoid arthritis, and I ended up being first a scribe, then when she was in a wheelchair, her pusher, and eventually a very good friend of mine. So I know, not firsthand, but I know secondhand how it has its ups and downs. It can be really a disability one day and it can be all right the next day. Do you find the same thing?
This is exactly the way it is I can wake up and feel good and feel fine. It's what we call one of the invisible disabilities. So I have days, weeks, even months, even actually, depending on how good my medications are at the time, because I do have to change my medications, unfortunately, at the moment quite often because I'm having a bit of a bad spell. But there are times when I'm quite well and I can walk down the street completely unaided. I don't look like I'm having mobility problems. My hands are fine. They don't look sore. They're not lumpy or twisted. And you'd never know. And I have good days. I have good weeks and months. And then I have bad days and bad weeks and months. And in fact, the type of rheumatoid arthritis I have, I can wake up in the morning and be racked with pain on one side of my body in certain joints and certain ligaments. And it'd be so painful that I mean, just unable to move, unable to get myself to the bathroom, to be able to feed myself with this sort of part of my body. And the next day, literally 24 hours later, it's not there, it's gone, and I feel fine again. And then that can happen over a period of a day, 2 days, 3 days, a few weeks. So these flare-ups can be extremely short but extremely painful. And then there are the longer flare-ups too. All of this is managed through medication. And if for one reason or another, the meds stop working, which is what happens because our diseases change and move and grow as we grow. So your meds can stop working at any moment and you can get full flare-up. So it's an invisible disability often, not always, often an invisible disability, and it's extremely changeable.
Now, you talked about woman as witch, and before Shakespeare had even written The Tempest, woman as Eve had transformed into woman as witch. How are stories of magic, folklore, and witchcraft, how do they inform modern feminism?
I think this is really interesting, specifically where we're at now in the 21st century. I don't know if you've noticed, but it's something that I was very impressed by whilst doing my research into Sycorax. I was really aware on the sort of on the periphery of my life of young women really embracing folk magic and the name witch, and even the idea of covens, whether they be worshipping witches, i.e., have some kind of religious content, i.e., Wiccan or something like that, or non-worshipping witches, i.e., they're secular, but they're interested in nature, the idea of trees being ancient beings and the land being an ancient place, and witchcraft as something to use as a tool for well-being and communing with yourself and with your sort of real sort of deeper inner sort of as a form of meditation almost. But also, not just singularly, these young women come together as a sort of sisterhood in the way that feminists have always done since, the first wave of feminism. They come together as sisterhoods and they call themselves covens. And it feels like in the world that we live in at the moment, when there are so many, again, a rise of like misogynistic actors through social media specifically, and all over the world, with the Roe v. Wade in America getting rescinded, and this feeling that we're going backwards again, young women seem to be embracing the history of this kind of state-sanctioned murder of women, but taking it in a real sort of positive, sort of feminist direction. And I find that incredibly powerful and moving, in fact. Yes, I've just been so impressed by it. I've found so many young women practicing as witches in this kind of way.
Quercus Audio presents A Girl Made of Air by Nydia Hetherington. Read by Natalie Peeler. World on a Wire, The Fallen Star. Ellie McVeigh, The New York Times. June 14th, 1983. Manhattan, 10:30 a.m. Transcription, tape 1 of 1. Can you tell me who you are?
I've been called the greatest funambulist who ever lived.
You smile when you say it. Don't you believe it?
Sometimes.
Pause.
Sorry, I don't like being recorded very much. I've never been good at talking. I'd rather write things down. My voice is awful, isn't it? I don't recognize it sometimes. I never should have started smoking. I mean, once you're hooked. It's a lived-in voice, I suppose.
The recording's only for me. No need to worry. And your voice is great.
That's Natalie Peeler reading from A Girl Made of Air by my guest, Nydia Hetherington. Now, your first book came out during lockdown. Tell us about A Girl Made of Air.
So, A Girl Made of Air, as you said, it was my debut, and it took me a great deal of time to write it. I did, at the age of 40, I went and did a creative writing degree. I was in theatre for many years. Then I just started writing. I lived in Paris for a long time where I created theatre. And when I came back to London, sort of that theatre world wasn't available to me anymore. So I started filling notebooks and writing prose and fiction. And it was quite a surprise to me that I'd started doing this. So I managed to get on to a degree to do a creative writing degree. And I started writing a novel, and that became A Girl Made of Air. And it's based in a post-war circus, and it's about a tightrope walker. Again, it's the story of an outsider. She is rejected by her mother, and she's taken in by this character called Serendipity Wilson, who is a magical character. She is the magical character in the book. She's from the Isle of Man, and she is full of stories. So she tells our unnamed narrator, the person who the book is actually about, who becomes the funambulist, the tightrope walker. She tells her all these Manx folk tales and about these creatures on the Isle of Man. And she fills her head and heart with magic.
Was I babbling? I'll try to relax. You're the first person I've spoken to publicly, or privately for that matter, since my... I don't know what to call it, my retirement? That makes me sound old. Since my last performance. Yes, that's a decent description. There have been offers of interviews, appearances, and all kinds of things. To be honest, I couldn't face them. But I'm ready now. You came along at the right time. It's not that I care about being out of the public eye, you understand. I'm done with that. I'm babbling again, aren't I? Sorry. Please do go on.
So she becomes a character who kind of believes in magic, but also is very, very... She has her boots in the mire of her own trauma, we could say, and her head in this magical place. And it's about her life. She ends up moving to Coney Island. So that would be probably around the early 70s as she grows up. She ends up moving to Coney Island and becoming the greatest funambulist who ever lived. So she starts off on the what used to be the sideshow circus, sort of the end of that sort of, as things were starting to get a bit sort of nasty and things with gangs in that part of New York, in that part of Brooklyn. But she rises to be the greatest funambulist who has ever lived. And she becomes a star. But through this whole time, she lives with the trauma of having lost a child in the circus when she was a young girl, when she was that young girl full of trauma in back in England. And it's that search for that child that takes her to Coney Island. And it's actually the search for the child that gives her this fame, which makes her ambitious enough to rise to become this famous person. So it's a book of stories again. It's layers upon layers of story. It's got folk tales. It's got stories about the circus. It's got stories about different circus characters, but it's also got stories about trauma. So it's quite a deep, thoughtful book.
Was the tightrope walking a sort of antithesis for your condition?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed in literally a few months after I started doing my creative writing degree. Now, I come from a theatre background, but the theatre that I did was physical theatre. It had a relationship with circus work, if you like, and I'm a trained clown, trained theatre clown. That's what I was doing in Paris. So there are lots and lots of relationships between the sort of circus theatrical world that she was in and the world that I was coming from. And of course, once I was diagnosed, it was absolutely obvious that I'd never work physically in theatre the way that I had been doing for so many years. So yes, there's definitely a correspondence there. I'm not sure how conscious that always was, but it's definitely, definitely there.
And same sort of with Sycorax. She's living with chronic illness, but she becomes the most powerful person on the island.
Absolutely. I have a real need to show people, the world, whoever wants to listen, that unwell people can thrive and live beautifully well, even if you're in pain. No matter what disability you have, you can thrive and live well. You just live with this thing that you have to manage, this disease that you have to manage, this impairment, this disability that you have to manage. And it takes a lot of managing. It does. But you can also thrive and live a beautiful, wonderful life. And it's important to me that my characters, no matter how struck they are with illness or disability, that they are powerful people thriving in their world.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And now I return to my chat with author Nydia Hetherington, who narrated the audio version of her book, Sycorax.
My earliest memories are the smells, tastes and feelings of our family life. The fragrant odour of beeswax that lingered on the walls of our dwelling and on our skin, from the melting, softening and rolling of candles. Sour sweat mixed with musky earth when collecting honey with my father in the baking heat. Sulphur from the gently burning smoke pot we'd place in the hives through a small hole in the top. The catch in the back of our throats as we rushed to capture the smoke, quickly closing the hole with twigs and mud, locking everything in, suffocating the bees inside. We'd stand back then, breaths held as we listened to the panic and chaos of the imprisoned insects, waiting for the inevitable stillness, the silence. When it fell, it would be sudden and exciting. But when Sunny smashed the hive, how sad I'd be to see the colony dead. I'd cry out against our easy violence, sob at the sight of hundreds of tiny bee bodies, once so happily humming around outside our home, now lying dead in perfect circles of golden honeycomb.
Blind people in literature, they tend to be, you know, superheroes or wise sages and things like that. What are some other tropes in literature around other disabilities?
Well, I think it's very much that. It's the idea that you're brave and courageous. You have to be the disabled person or the person who's living with some kind of chronic condition is brave. They're courageous. They get over their problem. You know, they conquer their disability. They conquer their chronic illness. Now, you know, in real life, you don't conquer anything. You just live with it and you manage it, and that's fine. And this idea of the hero is jaded and extremely ableist. It's an extremely ableist view of how a great many people live in the world. You know, and it would just be lovely not to hear that anymore, not to find that in books anymore or films anymore, because it's just it's so ableist and it's so uncalled for and not needed. And so, yes, it's very true of people living with disabilities and chronic illnesses that, oh, we're seen as people that were so upset about the way that we have to live that we want to die and kill ourselves. There's always that as well. That's another trope, that our lives aren't worth living because we're not perfect. We don't have perfect health, so let's just fight to get ourselves euthanized or something. That's another trope that I really, really, really would like to see erased if possible.
Tell us about the dedication of Sycorax.
So I've dedicated this book. Well, I can read it to you if you like. I can read the dedication. It's a bit of a long dedication, but it was important to me, especially as I wrote this book through some of the COVID lockdowns. And as a person with an autoimmune disease, I was shielding. And I was shielding for 2 years, which means I almost didn't leave the flat for 2 years. I had the occasional trip outside just in a local field. It was occasional, it wasn't often, but really I didn't leave my flat for 2 years because I was told I should shield. I was told I was vulnerable, and I've come to hate that word vulnerable because it's got so many connotations now we live in I'm not going to say post-COVID because it's not post-COVID. We still do live in a COVID world. These are things that we still have to be very, very careful about if we live with immune deficiencies. So I will read this to you. The dedication simply says, for anyone who lives with chronic illness and pain, for the Spoonies, for every woman who has experienced medical misogyny, gaslighting and misdiagnosis, for those awaiting diagnosis who feel unheard and uncared for the undermedicated, for the sufferers of side effects from the medicines designed to keep them well, for every single person who has had to shield, for those still shielding, for the vulnerable, the CV, the CEV, this book is for you. And I mean that, and I meant that. I did write this book for people who are unwell. I absolutely did. And I hope that they can find something in it that speaks to them.
What is a spoonie?
So spoonies. So if you live with a condition that an energy reducing condition, so a condition that causes a lot of fatigue, which means that, you know, you might only be able to work for an hour a day. You might be able to go out just for maybe half an hour a day, and afterwards you have to rest because your body can do no more. Often though, people call themselves spoonies because you have so many spoons of energy a day. And so often you hear people say things like, oh, I've got no spoons left today, which means that's it, I'm done. Or you can count how much something takes. So if you say you have 5 spoons in the morning, how many spoons of energy will it take me to get up and go to the toilet? How many spoons of energy will it take me to get up and go and make a cup of tea? So you count your energy in spoons. And so people who find this helpful call themselves spoonies.
And finally, just at the bottom, you mentioned CV and CEV. Could you explain that one?
So clinically vulnerable and clinically extremely vulnerable. When the whole COVID thing first hit, if you were chronically unwell, if you lived with an autoimmune condition or perhaps a lung condition, you were told you were vulnerable, but there were the vulnerable on a scale. So you could be clinically vulnerable or clinically extremely vulnerable. And you were given different rules and regulations about how to shield and when to shield and when not to shield according to your amount of vulnerability to catching airborne disease.
Now, a few minutes back, we heard Natalie Pillar narrating from A Girl Made of Air, and yet you narrated Sycorax yourself. How many spoons did that take?
All of them and more. So I did shorter days than most people would do. I did go into the studio and it was a real joy to do it. I loved every minute of it, but it did absolutely flatten me. I did 3 hours in the morning because I work better in the morning. By about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on any given day, I am absolutely done. I sometimes push myself to do an extra hour, but it's difficult. I'm better in the morning than I am in the afternoon. If I know I'm doing something in the afternoon, I will rest all morning. So I did the mornings, 3 hours with a good break in between, right in the middle there. And it took quite a few weeks. So we did it quite slowly over quite a few weeks. So I'd do 2 sessions 1 week, then 1 session another week, then 2 sessions all the way up to, I think we ended up with 12 hours of recordings in the end. So I took it slowly and it did flatten me on those days. Yeah.
Did you feel it was important that it was your voice?
I really wanted to do it. So as I was talking about earlier, I come from a theatrical background. So I was an actor for many years, although I went into a different type of theatre, like devised and physical theatre. I am a trained actor and I'm not scared of reading and I'm not scared of performing. And in fact, I enjoy it a great deal. It's not what I want to do anymore with my life. I did it for a very, very long time. And it, you know, I just felt that perhaps using my own voice, because I thought I could do it justice. I thought I could do the book justice if I was given the chance. I thought perhaps using my voice might give it a bit more truth, if you like.
Now it is available in audio. It's available for people who prefer audiobooks, but it's also available for people who've got no choice, be it through sight loss, dyslexia, or hands not capable of holding a book. Is that important to you that it's now accessible across the board?
Absolutely, 100%. It's extremely important. Like you say, there are so many reasons why people read audiobooks rather than paper books. And yeah, it's absolutely crucial. I'm really happy to see the fact that, I mean, audiobooks are huge now. You know, it's a big part of the publishing world, and that's a great step forward, I think, for accessibility. A great step forward. It's a good thing. Yeah, really important. You know, you can go for a little ramble in the park, go and sit on a park bench with a coffee and just listen, can't you? You can take your time as you're going about your business, doing the washing up, whatever, you can take your time. Yeah.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we're downloading the audio version of the book is the cover. Can you give us a little audio description of it?
So the cover is in different hues of blues and greens as well. There are two huge waves on either side of the image. They are stylized waves, if you like, with kind of frothing at their edges. It's very beautifully done. It's almost like an epic storm, two waves, one coming one way, one coming the other way. And there are smaller waves, storm waves underneath, again in very vivid hues of blues and greens. And on the right hand side, just under the big wave on the right hand side, there's a tiny little boat that seems to be bobbing underneath the waves. And then just under that, it says in white lettering, Seer, sage, sorceress. In the middle of the image, between the two waves, the two frothing waves, is the word Sycorax, written vertically in silver foil. And at the bottom left-hand side, opposite Seer, sage, sorceress, you have my name in white lettering, plain white lettering, Nydia Hetherington.
Now, as you say, Sycorax is not a character we actually meet in The Tempest, but the unseen presence is influential all the way through. What gave you the idea to write the book in the first place, and how did you fill in the blanks that Shakespeare never told us about?
So, like I said, I was an actor when I was very, very young. And when I was in my early 20s, which is a long time ago, I did a fringe production of The Tempest. It wasn't very good, I have to say, but it was an absolute gift. I have always been a big Shakespeare fan, weirdly. As a teenager, along with all the David Bowie posters on my wall, I had playbills for the Royal Shakespeare Company. Not that I got to see them very often because it was expensive and, we didn't have very much money. But I was just a massive Shakespeare nut. I guess it was because I dreamt of the theatre and he seemed to be everything theatre was in my sort of youthful imagination. So I became a really big fan. So anyway, back in the early 1990s, I was young in my 20s and I was in this production of The Tempest, and I just wondered about her all the way through. It seemed just so bizarre that she wasn't in there. She was such a foil for all the action, and the way Prospero speaks about her throughout the play, I thought it was almost like he's jealous because he is her mirror in a way. He talks to Ariel about how she imprisoned you, the foul witch Sycorax, who imprisoned Ariel in a cloven pine. But then Prospero says, "Ah, but didn't I free you? And if you're not good and be my good servant, I will imprison you in an oak tree." And so the idea being that he's even crueler, that's got an even crueler fate. So I just thought it was a very It always seemed like he was jealous of Sycorax's natural magic, because she's a woman and a witch. So female magic seems to always be from nature. And male magic, like Prospero's, of course, comes from the intellect. So we all know it's all about Prospero's books. His magic comes from his learning and his studying around the subject. And so I always thought, this doing this terrible production when I was in my early 20s, I came across this idea and these thoughts about this silenced, invisible witch who's just not there on the stage but means so much to the play. And so through the years, I thought about her a great deal. And when I started to create my own plays, which is really the theatre that I did devised work. So I would come up with an idea, themes, tropes. And then I would devise a show around these ideas or, these visual ideas or these philosophical ideas. And I thought over and over, how could I put Sycorax on the stage? And I never could, and I never did, because I couldn't find a way in. And maybe I thought it was a bit too ambitious, or maybe I thought I wasn't good enough to do it. I don't know. Maybe I thought I didn't have the tools, but I never did it. And then when I did return from Paris after working in theatre for so many years, and I started writing, she was one of the subjects that was always just hanging around in my brain again. Is she something I can write about? Is her story something that I can explore? And so when I came to be on my own and to feel very isolated, I mean, I wasn't completely on my own. I live with my husband, so, but I spend a lot of time sort of in isolation over the COVID times. I started to think about her isolation on the island, about Sycorax's isolation on the island of the Tempest. And it just was a way in. My own vulnerability, clinical vulnerability to the outside world, became somehow knitted together with that of Sycorax's isolation on the island. And it just got me thinking. And I found my way into her. And if you like, in a way, because, my mental health suffered as well during that time, being locked in and feeling like the world was carrying on outside and people were just enjoying their lives and getting on with things. And I was just locked in this room, in this flat. It brought me to her. So, in a way, she was a way of unlocking me, in a way. She brought me outside. So, she was a real gift. So, from all those years ago when I first encountered her in my early 20s to being in my 50s, my early 50s, she came back and she kind of opened many doors for me. So I'm very grateful to her and for finding her story. And how did I fill in the blanks? I did a lot of research about who she might have been, and I went with one strand in that research, and I just ran with it, really. I just ran with this slight idea of this witch in Algiers, this storm witch in Algiers that an historian called Charles Lamb had written about in the 1700s. And I just thought I'd run with that. I thought it was a good way to get in, because there's something magical in that as well. You can't take the magic away from her story. I wanted to tell a story about chronic illness, but I didn't want to take any of the magic away from the story either. So yeah, so that's how she came to be, and that's how she came to me.
So we were talking about Prospero's intelligence coming from his reading and his learning, and yet the female intelligence coming from the natural world. That holds a large mirror up to the medical world, because it was all medical misogyny and doctors being men, treating men, and women going untreated.
I think it's interesting. Oh no, it's interesting that you sort of are thinking about that, because it's very true. So both professionally and also sort of non-professionally as well, you've got men are doctors, women are nurses. That's the obviously that's not true today at all, but that is still very much a picture in the 21st century that one might have in one's head. It's certainly not the truth of how we live today, but it's certainly a truth through history that men's intelligence comes from learning and women's intelligence comes from the natural world. Women know about babies, they know about herbs, they know about making brews to calm the nerves and things like that. And they seem to know almost instinctively, or it's handed down through a female line, whereas men go and learn about proper medicine at universities. And of course, women historically weren't allowed to go and get a degree for many, many, many years. It's only in recent history that women are allowed, even in the Western world, to be schooled and to learn and to get an education. It's very, very interesting.
Even today, the symptoms of a heart attack, we're told what to look out for, but that's the symptoms when men have a heart attack. But if women have a
Absolutely.
heart attack, it's completely different.
It's different symptoms, yeah, and that. Yes, it's true across the board. Yes, absolutely. And you talk about medical misogyny. Certainly. So I think, I'm not sure if my percentages are right here, but I did read somewhere that 80% of people who suffer from my autoimmune disease, rheumatoid arthritis, are women and 20% are men. I don't know how true that is, but I know it is more women for sure than men who suffer from this condition. And often when you first reach out to a GP, when you first start having symptoms, because you often start getting symptoms in middle age, sort of in your four, sort of late 30s, early 40s, that's the general pattern. It doesn't always happen like that, but that is a general pattern for autoimmune diseases. The first thing they talk about is the perimenopause. And the fact that your body will be changing, blah, 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 and everything is put down to that. And it usually, I am not unusual in having to fight to get blood tests and a diagnosis. Once I was on that conveyor belt, it all happened quite quickly, but it took about a year for me to get a diagnosis. And people have much worse experiences. Women have much worse experiences than I do, because women do not seem, women's pain does not seem to be listened to as seriously as men's pain. And this is in the 21st century. This is in, our world that we live in. And I can't emphasize enough how true that is. It is really, really true. It really happens. Women's pain is still seen as something that's perhaps natural. And it's not. Women's pain needs to be diagnosed. It needs to be managed. That medical misogyny, believe me, still exists. I've been through so many things, and I'm not alone. And I read about it all the time, and I speak to people all the time who have similar experiences. I had to ask to get a different consultant because of medical misogyny. And I did tell the particular consultant my thoughts and my opinions and why I was doing it. Because I just couldn't keep going and not being listened to when I was in pain and I needed medication and I needed a change of medication, which I was being refused, and all kinds of stuff. So it's still happening today.
And just finally, why is Shakespeare's Lost Witch still relevant today?
Well, for all of the reasons that everything we've talked about today, women's voices are still silenced, whether it be through medical misogyny, whether it be about the fact that as we're moving into a mid 21st century that seems to be going towards right-wing populism, any forward steps we've made through history from Shakespeare's time onwards in looking at equality for women, looking at women's voices being heard, we seem to be falling. And I hope that something happens to stop it. I hope that we can turn things around over the next few years. We seem to be falling into scary times. And people have said over the last few years that things like The Handmaid's Tale seems to be looking more like a non-fiction book more and more rather than a piece of creative fiction. So the voices of silenced women need to be told more than ever and louder than ever. And I'm really aware that there's been a lot of books on the adult sort of fiction market over the past few years dealing with this question of silenced women and bringing women's voices to the forefront. And that's a good thing. And I just hope that readers and the publishing world doesn't get tired of it, because I do think these stories still need to be told, and they need to be told loud and clear.
Although days were often stifling hot, nighttime was always cold. Even so, Atlas craved the company of the moon. Many times, deep in the night, we'd go for moonlit walks by the sea. Atlas and Sunny carried burning torches as we wandered through the midnight air. for the moon's light shone pale and misty in the thick velvet black of night. When the torches moved, they sounded like the beating of great wings, and I'd look within the flames for a fiery bird. Mostly, I'd watch the dark world through sleepy eyes, toddling happily between my mother and father, my giggling protectors. Their voices, always so full of fun, rippled into the night as we tripped along, their torches licking and dancing in the chilly air, sending me into trances.
Sycorax by Nadia Hetherington and A Girl Made of Air are both available wherever you buy your books or audiobooks. A Girl Made of Air is narrated by Natalie Pella and Sycorax is narrated by Nadia herself. And Nadia, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB Library has all the latest reading titles in a format that suits your needs. You choose the books, you choose the format, we deliver to your door. Follow us on Twitter at RNIB Library or find us on Facebook.
And finally, on today's Read On, a return to author Nadia Hetherington. For three book recommendations in Books of Your Life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
So yes, I have to say, of course, because I never stop talking, so I have to say, as a child, I was really bad at reading. I wish I could tell you this romantic story of how I was always with my head in a book and that's how I came to love books, and it's not really true. I had a very, very short attention span. I couldn't focus for long. I was a daydreamer rather than a reader. So the books that did touched me profoundly because they were so few, if you like. And one of them is Tales from Moomin Valley by Tove Jansson. These are a bunch of short stories about the Moomins, about Moomin Troll and Moomin Troll's family. And they are magical and they are beautiful and they are full of life and grief. And they're just so poignant.
The Moomin family had been living for some weeks in the valley, where they'd found their house after the dreadful flood, which is another story. The house was painted blue, Moomin houses usually are. It was a wonderful valley, full of happy little animals and flowering trees, and there was a clear, narrow river that came down from the mountain, looped round Moomin House and disappeared in the direction of another valley, where no doubt other little animals wondered where it came from. One morning, it was the morning that Moomin Troll's papa finished building a bridge over the river, the little animal, Sniff, made a discovery. There were still plenty of things left for them to discover in the valley. He was wandering in the forest when he suddenly noticed a path he'd never seen before, winding mysteriously into the green shadows. Sniff was spellbound and stood gazing at it for several minutes. "It's funny about paths and rivers," he mused. "You see them go by, and suddenly you feel upset and want to be somewhere else, wherever the path or the river is going, perhaps. I shall have to tell Moomin Troll about this, and we can explore it together, because it would be a bit risky for me to go alone." Then he carved a secret sign on a tree trunk with his penknife so that he could find the place again, and thought proudly, "Moomin Troll will be surprised." And after that, he scooted home as fast as he could so as not to be late for lunch.
That's Hugh Dennis reading from Comet in Moominland, part of the Moomin Troll series by Tove Jansson. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes, without a doubt. My comfort reread, and I've reread it many times, is Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. I don't know. I think it was the first adult book I ever read when I was either 15 or 16. I was still quite young. And it had such an enormous effect on me. And I still love every single page of it. And yeah, so I've read it, reread it many times, and I will reread it again on those rainy days.
One step brought us into the family sitting room without any introductory lobby or passage. They call it here the house preeminently. It includes kitchen and parlour generally, but I believe at Wuthering Heights the kitchen is forced to retreat altogether into another quarter. At least I distinguished a chatter of tongues and a clatter of culinary utensils deep within, and I observed no signs of roasting, boiling or baking about the huge fireplace, nor any glitter of copper saucepans and tin colanders on the walls. One end, indeed, reflected splendidly both light and heat from ranks of immense pewter dishes interspersed with silver jugs and tankards, towering row after row in a vast oak dresser to the very roof. The latter had never been underdrawn. Its entire anatomy lay bare to an inquiring eye, except where a frame of wood laden with oatcakes and clusters of legs of beef, mutton and ham concealed it. Above the chimney were sundry villainous old guns and a couple of horse pistols, and by way of ornament, three gaudily painted canisters disposed along its ledge. The floor was of smooth white stone. The chairs, high-backed primitive structures painted green, one or two heavy black ones lurking in the shade. In an arch under the dresser reposed a huge liver-coloured bitch pointer surrounded by a swarm of squealing puppies, and other dogs haunted other recesses. The apartment and furniture would have been nothing extraordinary as belonging to a homely northern farmer with a stubborn countenance and stalwart limbs set out to advantage in knee breeches and gaiters. Such an individual, seated in his armchair, his mug of ale frothing on the round table before him, is to be seen in any circuit of 5 or 6 miles among these hills if you go at the right time after dinner. But Mr. Heathcliff forms a singular contrast to his abode and style of living. He is a dark-skinned gypsy in aspect, in dress and manners a gentleman, that is, as much a gentleman as many a country squire, rather slovenly, perhaps, yet not looking amiss with his negligence, because he has an erect and handsome figure, and rather morose. Possibly some people might suspect him of a degree of underbred pride. I have a sympathetic chord within that tells me it is nothing of the sort. I know by instinct his reserve springs from an aversion to showy displays of feeling, to manifestations of mutual kindness. He'll love and hate equally under cover, and esteem it a species of impertinence to be loved or hated again. No, I'm running on too fast. I bestow my own attributes over liberally on him.
That's Michael Kitchen reading from Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte. Available in both audio and braille from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but some you've read recently. It's fresh in the mind. You'd like to recommend.
Oh, yes. So I recently read There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak. It's a multi-timeline, multi-place story which starts in the ruins of Nineveh in ancient Mesopotamia, and it goes through Victorian London into 21st century London via modern day Turkey. It is the story of the lost poem, the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's the story of two rivers, and it's the story of three people through the ages who are all connected by one drop of water. It is sweeping, it is beautiful, it is clever, and it's moving, and it's just the most wonderful book. And that's going to become one of my rereads, one of the ones that I just won't be able to put down and won't be able to stop rereading. It is a beautiful book.
It is an early summer afternoon in Nineveh, the sky swollen with impending rain. A strange, sullen silence has settled on the city. The birds have not sung since the dawn. The butterflies and dragonflies have gone into hiding. The frogs have abandoned their breeding grounds. The geese have fallen quiet, sensing danger. Even the sheep have been muted, urinating frequently, overcome by fear. The air smells different, a sharp, salty scent. All day, dark shadows have been amassing on the horizon, like an enemy army that has set up camp, gathering force. They look remarkably still and calm from a distance, but this is an optical illusion, a trick of the eye. The clouds are rolling steadily closer, propelled by a forceful wind, determined to drench the world and shape it anew. In this region, where the summers are long and scorching, the rivers mercurial and unforgiving, and the memory of the last flood not yet washed away, water is both the harbinger of life and the messenger of death. Nineveh is a place like no other, the world's largest and wealthiest city. Built on a spacious plain on the eastern bank of the Tigris, it is so close to the river that at night babies are hushed to sleep, not by a lullaby, but by the sound of the waves lapping at the shoreline. This is the capital of a mighty empire, a citadel protected by solid towers, stately battlements, defensive moats, fortified bastions and colossal walls, each rising 90 feet or more. With a population of 175,000 souls, it is an urban gem at the junction of the prosperous highlands of the north and the fertile lowlands of Chaldea and Babylonia to the south. The year is sometime in the 640s BCE, and this ancient region, which is lush with perfumed gardens, bubbling fountains, and irrigation canals, but which will be forgotten and dismissed by future generations as an arid desert and abject wasteland, is Mesopotamia.
There Are Rivers in the Sky by Elif Shafak is narrated by Olivia Vinnell and Elif Shafak and is available from RNIB Talking Books. And once again, Nadia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.